On-time performance improves, the 787 sees more delays, and a look at some of the aircraft development programs in Embraer and Bombardier. We'll be talking about that and more with the help of industry analyst Richard Abalafia on episode 27 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Welcome back, everybody. This is Airplane Geeks, episode 27. We are the Geeks. I'm Courtney. With me, as always, is Max Flight.
Hello, Courtney. Hello, everybody.
And this is our 27th episode. So, Max, is this official we've made it past the six-month mark?
Yeah, we're officially podcasters now, I guess.
Some quick news, and just to make sure we get this out at the beginning of the podcast, we will not be producing a podcast, the Airplane Geeks podcast, the last week of 2008, so that Max and I can take a little Christmas break. So next week will be the last Airplane Geeks for 2008, and we have some great guests lined up. But before we get to that, we have a fantastic guest lined up for episode 27. We're speaking with Richard Abalafia. He's the aviation industry analyst and vice president of analysis at Teal Group. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Hi, pleasure. Nice to be here. Virtually.
Virtually.
Virtually and electronically. Nice to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And we do have quite a bit of news to talk about this week. So what do you say we jump into it?
Let's get started.
First in the news, we're going to USA Today. The Today in the Sky blog, airlines on-time performance improves in October. U.S. Airlines on-time performance and baggage handling improved in October, and the carriers overall posted a lower rate of domestic cancellations compared to the same month a year ago, the DOT said Wednesday. Regional carrier Atlantic Southeast had the worst on-time performance in October, while regional carrier Pinnacle Airlines had the best. What better way to start the podcast than with a little upbeat news?
Well, it certainly is upbeat. You know, I guess allowing 3 hours to get between Reagan National and LaGuardia obviously works its magic, huh?
Yeah, the joy of padded block times, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not surprised about ASA, you know, one of the jokes, always sitting at airports and things like that. I mean, ASA is notorious. So no matter how much the industry improves its record, still a couple of laggards out there, I'm sure.
The an interesting point in this, if you'll remember from this summer, Pinnacle was one of the airlines that Delta had targeted as an on-time risk, at least what seemed to be an excuse to cancel the contract, in which case Pinnacle has now turned around to be the best in on-time performance. Compare that with ASA, as Richard alluded to, always sitting at airports, which has been the worst, and it's been the worst for quite some time. These two airlines are both heavily in and out of Atlanta, although ASA has the much higher percentage of their flights in and out of Atlanta. Among legacy carriers, Northwest topped the on-time arrival rates. Delta completed its $2.8 billion acquisition of Northwest in October. So far, the only news has been around the new Delta brand. However, don't let American Airlines know that, because they were quick to the party, coming in at the bottom of the legacy carriers, reporting the lowest on-time performance.
Well, you know, it's interesting about Pinnacle improving, I guess, as Dr. Johnson said, nothing focuses the mind like the sight of the gallows. So they've obviously gotten their act together.
You know, that's some motivation.
One thing that I've always thought about, I mean, shouldn't consolidations and mergers, in theory at least, make the whole system a bit more efficient? Or is it going to be an excuse to cut capacity, eliminate aircraft when possible, and reducing the margin, the surplus capacity that, tends to make these delays less likely? I really don't know.
Maybe all of the above.
Yeah.
This, of course, does not bode well for American, which has seen some very significant operational issues with their on-time performance, I think mostly out of Dallas. But I think the moral of the story here is avoid New York.
Yeah, under no circumstances go near New York or Chicago in the winter, but, you know, absolutely. And, you know, the least multimodal or whatever, the least connected airport ever devised by the airport authorities, JFK, that's simply an impossibility. Great for O&D traffic, but a nightmare to get around in.
Moving on to the second story real quickly. This from MarketWatch. Invest in aviation infrastructure, groups tell Congress relatively small investments could yield big local returns. If Congress were to include the aviation sector in its economic stimulus packages, more than 40,000 high-paying jobs would be created, aviation safety would be improved, and there would be positive effects for the environment, according to a coalition of aviation organizations. I think it's important to point out that AOPA, which produced the press release we talked about last week, was one of the members of that coalition. The report included in the industry proposals were more funds for airport construction and incentives to aircraft owners and airlines to install equipment to take full advantage of the next-gen air traffic control system. The group proposed some $3 billion to be spent in next-gen infrastructure, which would reduce airline delays, improve safety, reduce emissions. This also included the ADS-B, installing ADS-B transceivers, which would accelerate many of the economic and environmental benefits. This all according to this AOPA-led coalition.
So it's kind of funny, you know, the Obama agenda is all about infrastructure as a way of bailing out the economy, which is a smart strategy, except people start standing in line. Kind of reminds me of that Simpsons episode where the school strikes oil and everyone gets in line. So, I want a jazz class with Tito Puente. Just everyone grabs what they can, you know. So it's not surprising. The other thought I have is that, you know, this is just a new front in the great scheduled air versus general aviation and private jet battle over user fees,
right,
and whatever. But now that you've got this sudden arrival of, you know, all the money ever created, maybe that becomes less of an issue and the focus instead shifts towards, you know, what have you done for me lately?
Well, this is something we talked about, last week, is I believe it was last week when we read through AOPA's press release talking about how they needed to be a part of the economic stimulus package. And really what we ended up with was agreeing that, look, if this economic stimulus package comes out and AOPA's or the general aviation sector is not a part of it, how bad is AOPA going to look if they didn't at least ask?
Right, exactly. They have to step up and make the point, whether it's listened to or not is, you know, I won't say secondary, but it's a different issue.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are constituents, they pay the bills, you know, end of story, really. You know, what have you done for me lately yet again?
Right. And if you look at this list of the co-signers of this, in addition to AOPA, I mean, it includes just about every aviation organization you can think of. The Air Industries Association, the ATA, the Airport Consultants Council, General Aviation Manufacturers Association. There's, you know, 12 or 14 different alphabet soup organizations, and they're all asking for this together.
You know, I'm not normally known for my enthusiasm towards, optimism here. But on the other hand, you know, you look at, you know, possible options to restore the economic health of the country. Buying toxic subprime assets, bad idea. You know, saving General Motors ass, bad idea, probably. So what are you left with? I mean, infrastructure isn't a bad approach. And I'm thinking there's an upside in terms of air service in this country or private air access. You know, you have to spend it on something. Why not infrastructure? And if it's infrastructure, why not aviation? Sure beats getting people to drive everywhere.
Yeah, sure. It's a good point. And infrastructure investment obviously has, long-term payoff. It's not just a short-term, let's save this industry or this company, you know, this year. But the benefits accrue year after year after year. So it's got, I guess, a much higher multiplier effect.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Number one rule of economic or industrial policy, you reinforce success, not prop up losers. Absolutely.
Right. Good.
And in a related news article, the Airplanes Geeks lasted 27 episodes, at least 26, until the first Simpson reference was dropped by Richard Abelazia.
Yeah.
Proud to be
it
here.
It had to happen sometime.
I've spent 26 episodes trying to figure out how to work The Simpsons in, but just the golden tongue of Richard Abulafia.
It defines my life, so I guess it was inevitable, but thanks for the opportunity.
Oh, that's great.
Okay, moving into our real next story. This from theguardian.co.uk. Analysts see worrying trend in airport incursions. Protesters stormed the tarmac of one of Britain's busiest airports, shut down two airports in Thailand, and invaded a runway in Athens, and some experts see a worrisome pattern. Environmental action group Plain Stupid targeted Stansted Airport, northeast of London, in the most recent protest, cutting through its perimeter fence Monday and briefly knocking out Britain's third busiest airport. And I have to be honest here, when I read this news story that Max sent to me and I read the topic, I thought, how is it possible with all the capacity reductions and all and the economy the way it is worldwide that they're worried about runway incursions? But that's not what this is at all. It's not airplanes running into airplanes. It's airplanes running into protesters.
Wow. That's really something, a uniquely British moment. You know, it's a great civilization, but they also tend to be in a little of the, as they say, over their bullshit side. They tend to like their Greenham Common type, you know, protests. Of course, it also reminds me of that great British saying, whatever happens, we have got the Maxim gun, and they have not. So, hey, security, you know?
Well, with a name like Plain Stupid, who can blame them, right?
They're actually a fairly organized group. You can take a look at their website at plainstupid.com. And this organization has been around for a while. And as I say, they're very well organized, and they are very focused on bringing environmental issues to the aviation industry. At their website, a recent post from the other day, they state that the action at that airport has shown that the power of young people determined to turn the climate talk into climate action. We took the decision to disrupt the airport to directly reduce the CO2 impact of Stansted as a response to the government's consent to its expansion. And they go on. I mean, they certainly have an agenda, and they feel very strongly about it, and they're organized. I mean, this is at least intended to be a relatively peaceful organization, but with the frequency of these airport takeovers we've seen lately, it just really makes me wonder whether or not, you know, airports aren't vulnerable to other organizations that have much more sinister intent.
That's a good point.
In September 2006, Plain Stupid activists blocked the runway at East Midlands Airport in central England for several hours. In October 2007, they handcuffed themselves to check-in desks in Manchester. Earlier this year, five Greenpeace activists clambered onto a plane at Heathrow. And in Greece, Olympic Airlines employees upset over plans to privatize the state-owned carrier repeatedly walked onto the runway at Athens International Airport, disrupting flights. This, as much jest as I throw at this, this is actually a very serious issue. I mean, the success that has been seen by Plain Stupid, by what happened in Athens, and the way that the Thai protesters were able to kind of bring it up a notch and shut down the whole airport for several days, they're afraid of copycats and in other terrorist organizations realizing how effective this is and use this as a way to really push their agenda.
Oh, it's all concerning. I'm not so sure I'd throw the ties in there. That sounded like it was just a general, broad, anti-government protest. If it weren't for, you know, the airport, it would be cranes or something like that. But the rest, you got a point. I mean, this shows just how vulnerable the system is to people who really don't like the system.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I can't say it's going to be a huge issue because obviously these people are trying to make a statement rather than blowing up planes. But you never know when that line gets crossed.
Well, in some ways, and I guess my line of thought is that the Thai issue is the most alarming because it had nothing to do with aviation.
Mm.
Here is something that the protesters were upset about, and it is now, that's absolutely right, it is now a political statement, a way to really gain publicity for whatever your cause may be, whether it be, you know, the climate change or whether it be that you don't want your school to have to wear uniforms anymore. You know, whatever the case may be, they're worried, and the author of this article suggests that, you know, this may be a new form of of publicity of protests to shut down a certain airport.
That's a reasonable concern. And just because I can't get away from cheap shots, I'll have to say the real danger here is that protests like these could shut down Heathrow Terminal 5. Oh, wait.
One can only hope.
Oh, wait. Okay, moving on to our next story. This is from Aviation Week. Something that we've been so enthralled with the Eclipse fiasco that we haven't talked about the Embraer Phenom, which has recently won Brazilian certification. Embraer's Phenom 100, Brazil's first purpose-built business jet, won certification yesterday from Brazil's ANAC, and the FAA says U.S. certification is imminent. This aircraft, which looks an awful lot like, I think, the Premier from Raytheon, or even would definitely provide competition to the Cessna Mustang or the Eclipse 500 from Embraer, is at least intriguing. And it kind of lends credence, Max, to some of the things we were talking about with the amount of backing that needs to go in to a new aircraft venture such as this that Eclipse just simply did not have.
Someone who's long viewed Eclipse as somewhere between a practical joke and a scam, I'm glad to see it cheerfully going away or cheerlessly going away. Embraer is a really good company. And, you know, this looks like a good product. I've never really been a huge believer in the VLJ market. This looks good. I think the most important thing is they've seen the handwriting on the tombstone about regional jets. They're putting money into business jets. That's really smart.
Yeah, there are some interesting aspects to this with respect to certification by the FAA. The FAA has apparently said, according to this article, that there are some special conditions that need to be met, but that the FAA is not going to hold up certification waiting for them. They're going to, you know, kind of blast ahead with the certification and sort of cut it off with comments on December 29th. But, you know, that kind of reminded me a little bit about some of the flack that the FAA took for perhaps being a little maybe lenient with Eclipse by way of granting certification quicker than some people liked. I don't know if this is the same thing or not.
Well, it is kind of interesting. The FAA worships at the altar of growth. They love anything that justifies budget growth, more departures, more everything. And VLJs for them were, at one point, the great hope, you know, to justify it. I mean, departures
yeah, sure.
are down. Traffic is down, for gosh sakes. But VLJs, hope springs eternal. And I guess that's their, you know, more departure, great wish.
You know, and this is a topic that we could go on and on about because, the Phenom really kind of fits into the VLJ model, whether or not they're technically classifying itself as such. But with Eclipse, with the Mustang, with the Phenom, you know, there are a few carriers, or excuse me, a few manufacturers that kind of stick out that really haven't gone after this market. I think Gulfstream is an obvious example, mostly because they're very good at what they do. But Bombardier actually sticks out here as a manufacturer that, in direct contrast to Embraer, their longtime nemesis, as Embraer goes for these smaller business jets, and they capped their regional jet program at what, about 110 seats, I believe, and the Embraer was it 195. You have Bombardier, who's going towards the 110 and 130 seat aircraft and kind of leaving the smaller business jets to Eclipse, Cessna, and Embraer.
You know, it's kind of interesting also, the one player in this segment of the market that hasn't gone for a VLJ is Hawker Beechcraft. They, of course, make the King Air, and they seem to be betting, and successfully betting, that the good old twin turboprop is fully competitive. As a matter of fact, production rates for the King Air have never been higher. I believe up till now, they've, aside from that Eclipse bubble, I think the King Air has been produced in greater numbers on a recurring rate than any of the VLJs out there. So there's still a lot to be said for turboprops in that small size class.
Well, and it's long been said that the King Air is the smart man's business jet.
Yeah.
And I think, especially with the economic downturn, you know, you're kind of seeing, you know, Walmart numbers going up. Well, it's kind of the same thing with the King here. It may not be a truly apt comparison, but, you know, they're downsizing to the airplane. It's ridiculously economical. It's extremely smart. It just doesn't have the image of having jets on the back of it.
That's right. But if you look at total trip time, you'll see very little difference, you know, door to door. And, you know, the TBM 700 from Socata, Pilatus PC-12, you know, just a little bit below the King Air, they're also going great guns. So I think there's a lot to be said for our old friend, the turboprop.
Absolutely. So hopefully by this time next week, we'll be announcing our new sponsorship from Hawker Beechcraft. Probably not.
Welcome to the B-200 Aviation Podcast Hour, right?
That's right.
Well, moving into the next story, and this really kind of fits in with what we were talking about. Bombardier to bring C-Series 110 to market first. Bombardier's C-Series development plan calls for the Canadian manufacturer to focus on bringing the 110 model to market before the larger capacity 130. Now, here's the interesting part. Let's see. The Pratt & Whitney GTF geared turbofan-powered C-Series family. You remember we talked about the geared turbofans several months ago on the podcast. But they comprise of the 110 and the 130, as well as the extended range versions called the 110ER and the 130ER. In addition, Bombardier plans to develop a short-range, high-thrust variant of the 130, dubbed the 130XT, which will allow customers that do not have a requirement for the long-range capability of the 130ER to take advantage of shorter runways or improved hot and high airfield performance associated with the full 23,000 pounds of thrust from the GTF engine.
You know, I love this the look of this aircraft. I love the GTF. As you guys know, it's a fairly promising new technology, but I think this is the worst run aircraft program in a very long time. I mean, I've never seen anything like a program launch, actual industrial commitment, without anything resembling a firm order. That's exceedingly unusual. And the production plans for this plane are bizarre. But still, I like the look. It's an interesting development, the idea of high thrust. You know, I'm wondering if that's not some sort of Chinese market thing for Tibet or something. I don't quite know, but I'm sure there is a market for that.
Well, what immediately came to mind with the high thrust variant is the MD-90. Or the I think the A320 had the International Aero engines on it that gave you a little bit higher thrust. I may be switching the two engines there, but with today's technology, is there really that much of a market? Now, Richard, you mentioned China, which I have to admit did not enter my mind, and maybe that is an opportunity for them to market a high thrust variant. But, you know, outside of Denver, Colorado Springs, Salt Lake City, and maybe into Montana, where they won't be seeing many of these, really, what kind of market is there for this?
I think you're right to be skeptical. At the end of the day, it's a small niche. One reason I thought of China, you know, lovely little bit of aviation esoterica here, but years ago in Beijing, I saw a Trident 4, which was marketed mostly to China. It was just on static display, and it's the only jetliner that I know of ever built with a mixed power plant configuration. There was a fourth engine, a 5,000-pound thrust lift, boost, whatever you call it, engine built into the tail. And it was mostly for Tibetan airports and things like that.
Interesting.
That is interesting. A couple news items that I read that I did not include. One is that the Chinese government, however that works over there, has suggested in quotes to all of its airlines to cancel orders and let leases expire on their airliners. Depending on the authenticity of that story, could put some pressure on Bombardier here if, in fact, this high-thrust variant is aimed at China. My other thought on the high-thrust is, like you said, Richard, they don't have a firm order yet, so maybe this is a marketing ploy or a suggestion by somebody who may be willing to start signing on the dotted line, if only you'll push this program forward.
Yeah, it sounds right to me. Yeah, but I think they must be looking high and low for that.
Yeah, they've been living off of the letter of interest from Lufthansa since July, since the air show, I think. And it hasn't been firmed up. And every now and then you see a little mention that, you know, they're still talking and we're really close to signing a firm deal, but it just hasn't materialized yet. Hopefully soon.
For whom a letter of intent is too strong and too energizing, you've got the letter of interest, which makes you relax and go to sleep.
That's right.
Well, you know, Bombardier's in an interesting spot with their regional aircraft, and one that's not necessarily as bad as some might think. At least that's my opinion. On the small side, you know, everything that has built their regional jet program, which was the Challenger, which they continue to stretch now to a 100 seat variant, and when you get into that 90 to 100 seat range for that aircraft, which is an extremely strong airframe to be able to stretch it that far, that airplane becomes very economical. Not necessarily comfortable, but economical. And then, you know, how can you mention, Bombardier and their commercial aircraft without mentioning the Q400, which I think really is kind of seeing a fluctuating niche and a very profitable one at that.
Yeah, the 400's in a lovely spot. The thing about, you know, the best thing to do if you're in the regional market is to get the hell away from it. You know, 5 last years at aviation have been the best I've ever seen. I expect a lot of you and your listeners recognize these as great times, but the regional market grew by 1% annually over the last 5 years. Everything else was, you know, the average was about 9 or 10. And regional jets shrank, actually. The only thing that lifted the regional market were those props like the Dash 8. So you've got Embraer going into business jets, and you've got Bombardier hoping to make it into the big time. But those are the only smart options, really.
You know, and really one major factor in this and in Bombardier's ability to move into the 100-plus seat market really has been the scope clauses. And that's why we saw the bubble to begin with, where the cheaper regional pilots that were able to fly these 50-seaters, but not 70 and 90-seaters, well, now that bankruptcy has come, they've eased restrictions, eased the scope restrictions, and allowed the cheaper pilots into the 70, 90-seaters. It almost seems that the new scope is, well, mainline pilots will fly Boeing and Airbus, and regional pilots will fly Embraer and Bombardier, whatever they may be. If that line is drawn, I think the C-Series is going to have a very difficult time building any aircraft.
Well, that's a very good point. You know, these things, the scope clauses, are stubbornly persistent, but there has been progress, as you say. Looking at the various unions and their attitudes, I mean, they seem to think, okay, we gave ground to the 50s unlimited, 70s, yeah, we're getting to unlimited. They're still dragging their heels on 90 to 100. That's too much like a DC-9 and those wonderful 150 grand a year DC-9 jobs. You know, it's probably just too much. But you're right, it might eventually happen, might actually come to pass.
And to your point, I think I've changed my mind. You know, a big reason for those concessions and allowing the regional pilots into those 70 and 90 seat variants were the economic times. As poor as things are now, the airlines seem to at least be responding in you know, with the capacity cuts and with what needs to be done, you know, post bankruptcy, that they are not going to be able to go back to their mainline pilots and get those scope cuts, which leaves me in a very bearish position for the 110 and the 130 series, unless they can kind of get past the heavy aluminum pilot stigma of flying a Bombardier product.
Well, that's right. It's hard to see them in regionals, hard to see them on mainlines, really. I mean, Lufthansa makes sense, I guess, but domestic or intra-Europe, that's the lowest priority for a European flag carrier.
And you know, from the other side, you know, just to jump all over the spectrum here, what aircraft is going to rival this in capacity? You know, you have the A319, which is slightly larger. You have the A318, which can't compete. The 737-500 really can't compete either. You know, it's just far too heavy. So, you know, there is a niche there. But like you said, it's kind of the worst run aircraft program I've seen in a while. I did want to point out one additional thing here. Williams, who's from Bombardier, says Bombardier has seen some interest from the marketplace in a business jet based on the C-Series, but says that will probably be later in the program, as Bombardier is now focused on providing the C-Series to airlines.
I think I also saw a press release about a Broadway musical based on the life of the C-Series. That would be great. But, you know, I mean, yeah, I understand your point before. It's kind of interesting, the 110 arriving to the market first, because if it has maybe an upfront shot, it's perhaps displacing the Embraer 195 on that part of the market by using new engine technology. But I'm not really sure how you could get significantly better operating costs than the stretched version of a regional jet. So they're kind of between two very difficult places here.
Moving on to our next story, this from the Times Online. Airbus and Boeing plan loans for buyers. Boeing and Airbus are preparing to pump the world aviation market with billions of dollars worth of loans to carriers in 2009 to try to offset what is expected to be a very, very tough year for aircraft manufacturers. Now, you know that it's going to be a very tough year when they use very twice.
No hedging there.
This comes from an interview with Giovanni Bisignani. He's the head of the International Air Transportation Association, or IATA. He said the aircraft manufacturers are already trying to set up financial packages in anticipation of a forecast slump in aircraft orders and deliveries.
Well, you know, these guys have to maintain a more conservative approach than they did back during the last downturn. You can get into serious trouble financing stuff. The one positive thing is that aircraft are a bit more generic. They're more commodities than they were last time. Like, the worst thing that Boeing put on its balance sheets back in the early years of the decade was the 717, which was, you know, unmarketable to anybody else. But now that aircraft are, you know, sort of vanilla, like 737-800, A320, it might be easier, but they still have to be careful. And, of course, the fact that they've hired Hank Paulson doesn't imply any degree of carefulness. Kidding.
Well, Chris Terry, who is apparently a leading aviation consultant, said the manufacturers have been in denial. They have hoped that if they tell everyone it's okay, then everybody will think it is and keep buying. But realization is looming. Both Airbus and Boeing each have between 800 and 900 planes on their order books, many of which the carriers are not going to be able to take. The market has been exceptionally difficult since June, and exceedingly difficult since September. I can't say I disagree with his comments.
I don't either. The numbers are a bit strange. I mean, 800 to 900 each, that's 1,600, 1,700. Okay. The backlog is now 8,000. So I think it's a little bit more nuanced than the numbers he's saying, but yeah, you know, the trend is definitely there. On the other hand, people are hedging enders over at Airbus, now getting away from that absurd 40 per month A320 rate. People are backpedaling. I don't think they're in denial so much as perhaps just trying to present a brave face to the outside world.
Well, Richard, do you think that these plans to provide loans to the airlines? I mean, is it a move to try to protect that backlog? Is that what Boeing and Airbus are thinking of doing?
Yeah, protect the backlog, protect production rates, but you know, you have to be really careful. Obviously, you're putting that liability on your books, which means if things get worse, man, you get hit even harder. And then, of course, you are, in fact, favoring some customers at the expense of others. You have to be really careful about that. So you have to look for strategic deals on strategic products, and it's a seasoning. It's not a meat and potatoes thing. It's a seasoning. Now, Boeing Capital does a very good presentation about where the capital is going to come from. And, you know, they make the point, a very good point, that a lot of the Asian banks haven't gotten into the game. Sovereign wealth funds haven't really, Ex-Im Bank, a lot of the others. But it doesn't mean they will. It's just sort of the potential that they might. So we're still hoping.
It's also interesting that this... this kind of announcement comes from the head of the IATA and not from Boeing and Airbus themselves. And I don't know if this is something that the two airframers really didn't intend to be publicized at this point or not. But I just thought it was interesting that the source of this information comes from IATA.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe it's sort of the one person who can make a kind of broad comment on both players rather than just having them, you know, come out and announce it individually.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
What discussion of aircraft is complete without the 787? This from CNN
course.
Money. ANA mulling seeking compensation on Boeing 787 delay. All Nippon Airways said Friday that it is still considering seeking compensation from Boeing after the aircraft maker Thursday announced yet another delay in the delivery of its 787 Dreamliner jets. Boeing said Thursday it is pushing back the schedule of the 787 program by about 6 months as it unravels delays caused by a recent union machinist strike and by problems of improperly installed fasteners on the first few planes. This puts the program roughly 2 years behind schedule.
Well, one word for them, cryogenics. You know, maybe future generations will be able to restore this program to health. You know, it's a bizarre situation. You know, my take on it has always been that they've had this absurd plan from the word go in terms of timing, and when you have a ridiculous plan, it kind of just keeps making itself worse, because people try to meet these impossible milestones and shutting stuff out the door and not learning how to build a plane, so you have to kind of redo it each time, boutique production. So, who knows? I mean, in our forecast, we have the first plane towards the end of 2010, and I think we'll stick with that.
So do you think the risk here was associated with sort of the step change in technology that's used in the construction of the 787? Is that why it was kind of an unrealistic timetable from the start?
I think there were three things. That was certainly one of them, absolutely. Another was, I never, ever go against outsourcing, but this time they outsourced engineering of major components and integration, which in balance was probably not a good move, and they should reverse. And then finally, I think they were just trying to get an aggressive schedule past the money guys to make the program go. You know, if you remember back 6 years ago or so, there were all these articles about the battle for Boeing's soul between people who wanted to develop new planes, you know, old school Boeing, and people who wanted to take the money and, you know, build a walk-in humidor for all the board members. And the first group, the right guys, won, but the price for it was a schedule that was near impossible. Well, it was impossible. That's my theory, for what it's worth.
Now, yeah, Richard, sure. I'm sure that you haven't been able to escape the news story from last week, which was the leak of the Airbus presentation, the confidential Airbus presentation, I might add, that included confidential Boeing information.
Yeah, you know, that was something. He held a Geiger counter up to the computer screen, and it started racing madly. that was really something. The guy behind that, John Ostrower, flight blogger over at Flight, is one of the best sourced people you'll meet in the business. Was it deliberately leaked? I don't know. I really don't. There's so many complications with that, and probably the most intriguing part of that presentation was the assertion that the first production batch was notably overweight and not performing as possible. I think the upside for Airbus here is that this A330 thing could keep going for longer than anyone expected, certainly more than I expected.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, moving into our last news story, and this is the results of a poll put out by ATA, part of their Smart Brief newsletter. I believe they put out this poll, and it was a reader poll that they responded. But there are several questions here, and the responses are intriguing. At least give us a view into how their readers and how the aviation community views the future of aviation. There were a couple polls, of which I'll read you here the results of the first. Where will the next-gen satellite-based air traffic management system be in 20 years? 43% said not fully implemented due to government-private coordination issues. 34% says supplanted by a new technology before implementation. And only 23% said fully implemented and globally harmonized through public-private partnerships.
That middle one is the amazing one. Supplanted by a new technology before it is fully implemented. That's saying that a third of the respondents think that this is going to take so long that by the time it comes out, there'll be something else out there that's better.
that is an optimistic view.
I've got to be honest, Max. You know, I never even considered that. But as soon as I read it, I said, "Oh, that's me."
Yeah.
I really think that's where we'll be. A couple of other poll responses here. What will happen to the U.S. space program in the new administration? 49%, almost half, said there will be a decrease in space investment. 29% said continued commitment to exploration and other programs at levels similar to what is in place today, and 22% said there would be an increased investment to jumpstart the Constellation program. So a little pessimistic view at our space program going forward.
Interesting. Well, you know, I'm not surprised you spend $2 trillion bailing out the world, and sooner or later your discretionary spending gets crimped.
You've got to fix something.
You've got to fix something, yeah, at the end of the day. That's right.
Well, now it is some of the more interesting and more aviation-specific questions, and I did find these quite intriguing. The first question, more than 50% of delays nationwide originate from New York area airspace, even though it represents only 12% of the flights. What is the single best short-term method for reducing New York area delays? The number one response at about 29%, cap flights at congested airports. 27% said utilize more military airspace. 22% suggested the full implementation of the DOT Aviation Rulemaking Committee recommendations. 13.5% just simply said other.
And bringing up the rear
at 8% were auction slots of the highest bidder, which, as it turns out, Max, 8% is the exact number of ATA subscribers who are in the FAA.
Yeah, probably.
Not really.
Oh, gosh. Boy, imagine what that would do to Continental's ERJ flights out of Newark.
Uh-huh. Which, I might add, was the most delayed flight. Going back to our first story, at well over 80% of the time was a flight out of Newark on an ERJ.
You know, I've always wondered how that worked. You know, I mean, you've got this big catchment area, tiny places, you know, the Schenectadies of the world. And I don't know how you maintain a level of air service like this, you know, while not switching to market-based economics. It's a bizarre situation.
We talk about the big three in New York, of course, LaGuardia, JFK, and Newark. But, you know, you have some of these surrounding airports, you know, Southwest and Long Island Islip comes to mind. You've got Newburgh, White Plains, which is somewhat restricted, even all the way up into Hartford. You know, these are all markets that are at least connected by rail service to New York and really can kind of be considered within the New York catchment area. Shoot, you could even go down to Atlantic City and Philadelphia if you really want to push it. But like you mentioned earlier, Richard, I mean, it's archaic in its kind of design. You know, JFK, to be a perfect example, I mean, there's enough concrete there to... You know, make up your analogy, but you can't move enough airplanes through there. I mean, it's the biggest almost waste of resources.
New York, you know, it needs. You look at it. I mean, JFK is a legacy of the 60s. You know, everyone will drive. We'll build a freeway through it. You talk about concrete. Yeah, it's nothing but. And then there's the glorious Marine Air Terminal at LaGuardia. I mean, this is sort of world of tomorrow as seen by 1939, yeah, but gone horribly wrong. I don't know how you redo it.
Okay, Richard, since we didn't really have a main topic, we want to make sure that we don't fail to give you the opportunity to suffer through what we call word associations.
Like an ink spot test?
Yeah, exactly. Just like
yeah,
that.
Pretty close. Yeah,
yes. We will forward all your results to anybody that you may have worked with in the past, anybody who may owe you money. The name of the game, I mean, it's really quite simple. We're going to give you a word. Just tell us the first thing that comes to mind.
Cool. Sounds great.
So if I say A380, what thought pops into your head?
A3 turkey.
A3 turkey. You think it's going to be a long-term success or no? Or?
You know, I mean, it's $20 billion and they'll be lucky to recover the production costs. It was a niche machine, and it was a very expensive niche machine. It's distracted them from their more important goal of bringing the A350 to market and actually competing with Boeing. You know, people think, you know, this is still a debate, but it really isn't. Since the A380 was launched, there have been 192 orders, and for smaller, wide-body, long-range jets, 777, A330, whatever, the number's approaching 3,000. For the 350, which of course was launched way after that, it's now at 450. I think the market is speaking very loudly here. Having said that, the A380 is a cool plane, and my one test flight, and it was just it was a pleasure. So, a tricky in the market sense, but not in the technical sense. That's for sure.
Okay.
Okay. My first word, Richard, if you're ready.
Yeah.
Eclipse.
Loser.
No, really, and we don't want you to hold back at all, Richard. Really, I mean, just let us.
Yeah, tell us what you really think.
I mean, we'll let the lawyers sort it out, shall we say? But you know, you had a business case from the word go that looked completely insane to analysts in the business. It was either somebody or some people drinking their own bathwater in copious gallon drums. Or it was a deliberate effort to engineer a bubble and attract investment from people who just didn't know better. I mean, the numbers were so crazy from the word go, you know, and you had this absurd low price tag that depended on absurd production numbers and absurd production numbers that depended on a ridiculous price tag. I don't know where to start. Actually, I do know where to start. I'm rambling, but it's the most awful thing I've seen in the business. Yeah, and there's the human cost, too, and the financial cost. I mean, enough people believed in this to make their lives miserable. You know, the people laid off. It's not just at Eclipse. It's at the subcontractors, the Pratt Canadas, the Hampsons, the Avios, what have you. I mean, there were enough people committed to this to really feel some pain, and I think the world should be wary of this sort of thing ever happening again.
Okay, Court stole my second word, so I'll have to think of one here that he probably won't think of. Richard may have to explain this a little bit, but my next word is A-12 Avenger.
Oh, my goodness, the A-12. Gee, I think the only word is lawsuit. You wanted me to come up with something. Oh, yes, the Flying Dorito, as it was known, the Navy's carrier-borne stealth aircraft. The only thing that came out of it was lawsuits. There wasn't even a prototype after spending $4 billion. Yeah, and not only that, but years later, the lawsuit is still humming away. I'd love to be a lawyer on that program. I just plan my retirement on the basis of that.
Are there some lessons we learned about termination of military contracts from that little episode?
Oh, absolutely. Matter of fact, if you want a very entertaining, well, it's heavily legalese, but the $5 billion misunderstanding by Jim Stevens and Naval Institute Press, a lot of minutiae in there, but basically don't do fixed price development contracts, number one, because even though they sound appealing, they end in disaster very often. And the other is actually getting to the heart of your question. If you're a service, make sure you find a fault. Make sure you find a reason. Don't do it just because you feel like canceling. Because even though you might be totally right, as I think the Navy was this time, they don't have an actual reason to have done what they've done, and I think they're probably going to wind up heavily in the hole for that.
Okay, my second word, cabotage.
Hope springs eternal, I guess, is my... that and Cabotage Patch Kids, if you remember the popular dolls.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I could get on my soapbox and go on and on about the virtues of free trade, but it still baffles me that I can buy a BMW, but I, you know, can't fly on an Air France flight to Denver. You know, it's... but who knows? Mm. Hey, you know, as we all know, we're only about two-thirds of the way through the many freedoms of air travel. So, hey, we'll get there eventually.
Okay. My third, aviation consulting.
Loser. No. yeah, well, no, it is what it is. I do love my job, but it has its ups and downs, shall we say. No, but it's... you know, I consider myself the luckiest person that I, in my circle of friends, I really love my job. And yeah, you look at this business, anyone who's had any kind of contact with it knows that, you know, this is it. When it bites you, you have to stay with it. And yeah, for some reason, I got a job as a consultant, which means unlike pilots or engineers, I have, no actual useful skills or talents, but worked out pretty good.
You do get to travel a lot.
Well, there is that. Yeah, mixed blessing in this day and age, but
sure.
Yeah, there is that.
Sure.
Well, like they say about consulting, if you can't solve the problem, there's a lot of money to be made in prolonging the issue.
Absolutely. You know, it's like borrow the client's watch and charge him to tell you the time.
It doesn't get much better.
Okay, my last word then is actually a couple words, Richard. Airplane geeks.
Like it a lot. I mean, I like the feel. I like the whole idea of, you know, I mean, we all want to emulate car talk, and this is as close as I've seen to getting there. So kudos to you, and thank you very much for including me.
Richard, thank you for joining us. It really has been a pleasure. Again, that's Richard Abulafia, an aviation industry analyst and vice president of analysis at Teal Group. Richard, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. A pleasure.
Thanks again to Richard Abulafia for joining us for episode 27. Max now has his picks of the week.
Absolutely. My pick this week is something simply called aircraft nicknames. And this comes from b737.org.uk, which is kind of a enthusiast site that centers around that aircraft. But what they have is a pretty extensive list of, we call them nicknames or pet names for different kinds of aircraft. And this is a compilation of nicknames for aircraft that they've picked up from a lot of different sources, including the Prune, the what's that? That's the Professional Pilots Rumor Network, which is a actually kind of a good forum if you're into that. But what they do is they list a number of aircraft and what are the nicknames for them. So, for example, an A380 is called the Megabus, an A320 is called the Minibus, A319, the microbus, and I like the small A318, which is the nanobus. And you can find this for not just Boeing and Airbus aircraft, but Beech and Cessna and de Havilland's and just about anything you can think of. Some of them you'll recognize, the F-111 Aardvark, also called the Pig. It's just kind of a fun thing to look. Most of these are pretty clean. There's a few in here that are a little bit unmentionable that I won't repeat on the podcast. And I have to say, I don't really know what the joke is behind them. But if you're familiar with that airplane, it probably will mean something to you. The way I got turned on to this actually was through a different website called AviationAlias.com. What these guys do is they produce these vinyl cut stickers that let you display sort of a graphic of your favorite airplane and its nickname or its alias, as they call it, on hard surfaces like car windows or on a laptop computer or a notebook or on your flight bag or anything like that. So that if you've got a favorite airplane, either because you're a pilot or a crew member or an enthusiast, you can take a look at aviationalias.com, see if they have a sticker that matches with your interest. And they say that if they don't, let them know, and they may be able to create a sticker for you. So kind of a fun way to show your enthusiasm for your favorite aircraft.
And that kind of got me thinking, Max, of all the nicknames for various aircraft and airports that are out there. And I figured, who better to come up with fantastic nicknames or aliases for aircraft or even airports? You know, Detroit is known as Detroit Toilet. LaGuardia is La Garbage. JFK is known as The Parking Lot.
The parking lot.
Who better to come up with these nicknames than our listeners? So, a request to our listeners of the Airplane Geeks, send us some of the nicknames of either aircraft or airports that may be specific to maybe an airline or some of the publications that you read. We're always interested in hearing those, and you can send those to the geeks at airplanegeeks.com. You can even give us a call on our voicemail at 812-757-4252. and leave them there, or any suggestions or comments you have about the podcast as well. Couple of announcements. We already talked about the last Airplane Geeks for 2008 will be next week. We've got some great guests lined up for that, but don't expect one after that. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to all instead. And also, we ask that you check out Flightline Internet Radio. Most of our listeners are aware and have been listening to Flightline Internet Radio, where you will hear some of the geeks, but they have picked up a little bit more aviation content programming, and I, for one, am enjoying it very much. So check them out at flightlineinternetradio.com. Also, Max seems to have kicked a hornet's nest over at Simplifying, which was our pick of the week last week. Shawshank Nijem's blog post with he had an interview with Laura Reese, who is a marketing and branding executive with a consulting company. And there are some very interesting thoughts that Laura brings up about an airline's responsibility to corporate blogging and such. And we suggest that you go over to Simplifying and listen to the both interviews. They're in two parts with Laura Reese and join in the discussion. Shawshank has done an outstanding job with this blog, and we'd like to... we'd like to prep the conversation or the discussion that we're going to have with him on January 4th. So if we could, if our listeners would go there and join in the discussion, we would greatly appreciate that. And so would Shawshank, bringing some traffic to his website. So it's very interesting. It got me going this morning, Max. I couldn't go through this podcast without mentioning it.
I know. I did post a couple of comments, and I really had to restrict myself because I found myself wanting to compose a short story. It would have gone on for pages. So there's some interesting issues that are raised. This is definitely a must-see blog in general, but this particular topic about airline branding is something that people will, I think, enjoy contributing to.
We did have one email. This from Mikhail. He says, "Hi, Court and Max. Just want to tell you that I enjoyed episode 26 so much, and it cracked me up. I just can't stop laughing, especially when you discuss the cabotage and flight crew hierarchy in FAs of other countries compared to flight attendants in the U.S. And I definitely agree with Court. Captain Chris was a trip. He's very funny. Hope you'll invite him again. We most definitely will." But as I was mentioning to Max before we started recording, as I was editing last week's podcast, I didn't realize that I had gone off on such a tangent about the flight attendants. And what I never had the chance to say was that I was not suggesting that the U.S. be allowed to fire ugly flight attendants as some of the other parts of the world was, but that I thought other parts of the world should not be able to get rid of flight attendants based on age, looks, or anything of that. So kind of got carried away there. I appreciate the comments, Mikhail. If you would like to send us an email, you can do it by sending it to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Again, I'll mention the voicemail, 812-757-4252. Of course, you can always record an MP3 if you know how to do that. That's the best way. Email that to us directly at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We also ask that you check us out on iTunes, leave a review for us. And Max, what's the best way they can support us?
Send cash.
Yes, that's it entirely.
No, no.
We only take $1,000 denominations. So
minimum. But other than that, tell your friends, tell anybody that you know that's interested in aviation, interested in podcasting, or learning more about what's going on in the world of aviation. Let them know. Spread the word.
Absolutely. And again, big thank you to Richard Avalafia for joining us this evening. He really is a trip and an extremely intelligent gentleman and a leading voice in the airline industry and aviation industry as it is. So thank you again, Richard.
All right. Just one little word of wisdom. Just remember, everybody, flying isn't dangerous. Crashing is what's dangerous.
That's right. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Join us next week. It'll be the last episode of 2008. It'll be episode 28 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We'll see you guys.
Bye, everybody.
You were waiting on that, weren't you, Max?
Yeah, caught me once, you know, and I was like, I am, well, I so I thought I would be ready with at least something.